Right, good evening, everybody. I stopped counting how many venues of the Aloha I visited. This is definitely one of my favorites. I love this. This is amazing. I hear Chris is speaking a lot about prosper and prosperity, so is this becoming a prosperity gospel type of church? Okay, so thank you for having me. Sounded to me like I was talking about a lot of really, really highfalutin stuff. I'm not sure I'm going to reach all of that, but let's see how far we get. So I was asked to speak a little bit about neuroscience and its relationship to the soul, or the existence of the human soul. And that's what I'm going to focus on. This is going to be a slightly strange talk, because it's going to start twice. Okay, so if you want to have a nice surreal experience, this one's going to start twice. I want to do something in the beginning, and then I'm going to start again. Hello, Ray. Okay, so before I do that, I just wanted to show you some of the sources that I've used preparing. So I'm not an academic in this field. I'm not a neuroscientist, and I'm not a philosopher. I'm a Christian, and I'm a thinking Christian. And as a result, I try and understand when people speak about things that affect faith and or the existence of God and or the existence of the soul. I think those are all important things to think about. So in preparation for this talk, I've used a few sources. The main source I've used in terms of the Christian view of this is a philosopher called J.P. Warner. If you've not heard of him, he's a really interesting guy, good to listen to. And one of the things he likes to talk about is the existence of the soul and dualism and or not. Okay? And it's quite interesting. I also read this book by Kevin Nelson called The God Impulse, Is Religion Hardwired into Our Brains? And then probably my favorite one is this one by Michael S. Gazzalinga, Human. The science behind what makes your brain unique. This is a fascinating book. It's getting a bit old now. I actually wish he would write an updated one. It's a fantastic book because it really goes into what makes the human brain different. And neither of these books, by the way, are written by people who would consider themselves people of faith. As a matter of fact, Gazzalinga would consider himself an atheist. Okay, so these are not Christian views on the topic. These are just views on the topic that I read in preparation. They're both popular, as you will notice. Now, I wanted to just mention something right in the beginning, because part of this debate and part of this discussion has a lot to do with what the facts mean. So we will have certain facts on the table, but often we have to ask what those facts actually mean. And what I found interesting is when I looked at the reviews of this book at the back, you know, you always have a blurb at the back when you write a book. People have to recommend your book. So this book was recommended by two different parties. The first party that recommended this book was the Daily Mail. High, classy, academic recommendation you can expect it, right? So what does the Daily Mail say about this book? It says, reveals the startling truth about near-death experiences. Compelling. Okay, so that's what the media says about this research. Now, this guy's a good researcher. I'm not listing him as a researcher. But that's what the media said about this book when they read it. So what does a colleague of his say? By the way, a colleague who's not a person of faith at all, but quite a known scholar, V.S. Ramachandran, okay, what does he say? Now listen to the difference in what he found this book to be. He says, a bold, provocative, and highly readable account of the author's journey into the world of religious experience and its possible biological basis. Can you hear the tentative nature of that comment? This is a colleague, he's in the field of research. The Daily Mail tells us, reveals the startling truth, okay, about near-death experiences. It's compelling. And a colleague tells us slightly more nuanced and slightly more humble. It's a personal journey, it's interesting research. What does it actually mean? We're not necessarily that sure. And I think as we move into this talk, it's important to say that the facts don't speak for themselves. They have to be interpreted. I'm in academia. My wife is a researcher. Facts don't speak for themselves. They have to be interpreted. And the interpretation is often where things get messy and difficult. Okay? And as a result, you're going to have to bear with me a little bit tonight. So let's move into the talk. Now, this is going to be tough. It's a Sunday night. Hopefully you've rested and you've slept. Okay, so I did say this when I did this Afrikaans version, but I want to say to you, I've really had people fall asleep during my talks. But when I did this one the first time, it was in a group of slightly elderly people who were in their 70s and above, the youngest people in their 70s, and the one I fell asleep was literally sitting right across from me, like about a little bit further than you sitting now. But not only did he fall asleep, I mean, I wouldn't even mind if you fell asleep. If you're tired, please have a good sleep.
would be the best thing you could do with your time. He snored.
So his wife was sitting right next to him, and she just put her hand on his knee. And I knew, okay, this talk wasn't going quite as well as I expected it to go. No, the reason why that happened, it was a Sunday afternoon. The talk is quite tough. And I think it was just a bit too much for him. And maybe I was boring on that day. So let's put that in the mix as well. But it's going to be a slightly tough talk, this, ladies and gents, because we're going to have to delve into some things that we don't generally think about. Okay? But let's jump straight into it and see what I've got to say tonight. So, I want to start with something that's got almost nothing to do with the theme. I want to go take us back to 1961, when the Russians were the first to go into space. Okay. Now, when I did my reading on this, I also found some very interesting things. You know, we think we know what history says, but when you go and look at it, it's sometimes completely different. So, in 1961, the Russians were the first ones to go into space. Would you go into space with that?
Not me. My insurance wouldn't cover that, I'm telling you.
Okay? Then they go into space. They came back. Yuri Gagarin was the first man into space. They came back, and then the Russians, actually Nikita Khrushchev, who was the leader of the USSR at that point, the leader of the Politburo, made a statement. And that statement said, Gagarin flew into space, but he didn't see any God there. Okay. Now, let me just stop there first and say, the people who know Gagarin says he actually was an Orthodox Christian, and they say he never said that. Okay? Now, it's very difficult to know. Gagarin isn't with us. He can't speak for himself. But what we do know is that Khrushchev said this. Gagarin flew into space, and he didn't see any God there. If you are a theist of sorts, any sort of theist, would you expect to find God sitting on a cloud or a star in space? Would you expect to find him or her or it there? I don't think so. So all that was cheap politics. Do you agree? I mean, that didn't shake anybody. If that shook your faith, you must please come and see me. We need to talk about your theology, right? Flying into space and there's no God there. That's not theology. I don't know of anybody who thinks about God, who thinks that God sits somewhere in space waiting for us to come and find him as a spacecraft. And I'm going to start here, because I think sometimes things are said in the popular media for almost political reasons more than anything else. And let me go and see what people say today. I'm going to use somebody who is a neuroscientist. There we go. Okay, Sam Harris, one of the new atheists, but he's also a neuroscientist. Let's listen to what he says about neuroscience and the existence of the soul. How can we be free as conscious agents if everything that we consciously intend is caused by events in our brain that we do not intend and of which we are not entirely aware? Okay, and second part, I've got two more in the next slide. You are not in control of your mind because you, as a conscious agent, are not part of your mind, living at the mercy of the other parts. Okay, let's look at the next two because I'll stop there for a second and just spend a bit of time on what he says. There is no place in your brain for your soul to be hiding. This is quite a famous quote. It's not in the book. It is quite famous. This is actually from his blog. There is no place in your brain for your soul to be hiding. And then the last one. Decisions, intentions, efforts, goals, willpower, etc. are causal states of the brain, leading to specific behaviors, and behaviors lead to outcomes in the world. Human choice, therefore, is as important as fanciers of free will believe, but the next choice you make will come out of the darkness of prior causes that you, the conscious witness of your experience, did not bring you to be. Okay. So there are people, and I'm obviously using somebody who is quite blunt about this, there are people who say that because we now understand how the brain works, or at least a little bit of how it works, we do not need to postulate a soul anymore. We do not need to talk about a soul anymore. All there is the electrical activity in the states of your brain. And all of this is caused by prior states and biological states, and all of this is caused by physics and chemistry, etc., etc. That's as far as a guy like Harris will go. Okay? In other words, because of neuroscience, we know that the soul does not exist. That is the basic conclusion. And I think it's summed up beautifully there. There is no place in your brain for your soul to be hiding. And I want to spend a bit of time to ask, is that actually a valid way of thinking about neuroscience and to think about the soul? Because although people can say stuff like that, it is still true to say that all of us have this overwhelming experience that we are not just our bodies. I don't care what your belief system is tonight, all of us have this experience that we are not just our bodies. Okay, as a matter of fact, a guy like Dazeninga, who would call himself an atheist, would say in this book, those two quotes, the next two quotes come from this book, he says, we all act like dualists. Whether we say we are dualists, now what is a dualist? Let's just take a second there. A dualist is somebody who says there is a body and soul and they are separate entities. They are intertwined, but they are separate things. Okay? And then you get a physicalist like Harris, who says everything is physical, everything is the result of chemistry and physics and electrical activity in your brain. So what Dazeninga is saying, I might be a physicalist, but I act like a dualist. And he goes one step further, and then he's going to illustrate it beautifully. He says, we are going to talk about why most people believe they, their body and soul, are separate, and why even people who don't believe they are separate act as if they are separate. And then he gives a lovely illustration of how everybody acts. Okay, and let's look at his illustration. So he says, if someone cuts in front of you on the freeway, you don't think, gee, what an influx of catecholamines in that chunk of cells in front of me. No, that's not what you think. You think, what makes him think he is so important that he should get in front of me? What a jerk. Okay? I don't know anybody who doesn't do that. Okay? And if you think like that, you're thinking like a dualist. I don't care what your position is tonight, but you are thinking like a dualist. And Dazeninga has the guts to say, yes, all of us think and even act like dualists, whether we believe in the soul, the existence of the soul or not. And I think it goes beyond that. Our whole society is built on the idea that people are morally culpable for their decisions and actions. If Harris is right, and your next decision is just the result of physics and chemistry and previous brain states, how can I hold you responsible for that? You are just as responsible as a stone falling from a mountain and hitting my foot. I mean, I get mad, I get sore, but I'm not really mad at the mountain. I don't take it to court. I don't hold it morally responsible, do I? Because I can't. And everything in our society tells us our decisions and actions are things we, as individuals, are responsible for. Our whole legal system is built on that basis. And then love and many of the other most meaningful experiences we have are not just they're not satisfactory at least, but they're just physical. Okay, so now we're done with the introduction. Now we're going to start with the actual talk. Okay. Because quite importantly, I think it was important to say that there are people who say that neuroscience will lead us to not believe in the existence of the soul. But then many of those same people will tell us we cannot act and think as if we do not have a soul. It almost seems to come naturally to all of us. Okay, so what is the relationship then between neuroscience and the soul? And this is where, as they always say in aeroplanes, you're going to have to fasten your seatbelts, ladies and gentlemen. Okay. There will be oxygen masks falling from the sky if you need them, if the pressure gets a bit low. But this is I'm going to move. And some of this is going to be quite tough. And I do know a lot more is to be said. And of course, I'm representing a point of view. At the end of this, I will make the power go off and I'll run out. Nobody will be able to argue with me. No, I won't. I'll stick around. You can talk. Okay? I'm not saying I'm right on all of these things, but I'm putting a Christian point of view forward for you to listen to now. Okay? So this is a picture of a dog drinking from a fire hydrant. That's the experience you can have right now. Okay, we're going to move through this, and it's going to be a lot and tough, and if at some point I lose you for a few seconds, don't worry too much, you can come back in the question time, but I did include quite a few things that I could have possibly left out some of them, but I didn't want to leave them out because I thought they'd make a nuanced picture, and therefore I left them in. Okay, so, philosophy of mind is an area of philosophy that has had a lot of attention to it, the discussions in the philosophy of mind, if you go and read philosophy or you study philosophy, gets really deep and dark and heavy stuff. I'm going to try and stay away from that in depth. I'm not going to go into that into a lot of depth. And I want to just acknowledge the fact that there is a lot more to be said about this. I've already spoken about dualism and physicalism. And I think, hopefully I was clear enough on what they mean. If I wasn't, please put up your hand now and just tell me, and I'll just explain them again. Okay. because I think they're important concepts for us as we move forward. Okay, so I'm going to stay away from the philosophy, but I cannot stay away from it completely, because I don't think the facts on their own are going to tell us the answer. We're going to have to do a little bit of philosophy as we move forward. But I'm not a philosopher. I didn't study philosophy of mind. Then I need to also clear out that this is not a conflict between religion and science talk. I don't think that Christianity is or should be anti-science. And I don't think science is, in its essence, or should be anti-fact. I don't think these two things are in direct competition. There's very much a metaphor that it is. And I want to say to you, nothing that I say tonight, because I'm going to be critical of a guy like Harris, of course, but nothing I say tonight should make you think, as a Christian, I'm anti-neuroscience, because I'm not. I'm very much for it. I think it's a very, very exciting field of research. And it's something that should be pursued with a lot of strength and power and resources. But I also want to nail my colors to the mast and say, I don't have any doubt in my mind that the scientific method is a priori. Before it even starts, it decides that it's anti-supernatural. And when I say anti, I don't mean it's trying to squash supernaturalism. It is a methodology that excludes the supernatural from its frame. It cannot look at anything supernatural, and it does so on purpose, and that's a good thing. But as a result, it's not very difficult. It is per definition impossible for science to really say anything about the supernatural. I don't think it can, because of the methodological choices and the philosophical choices it has made in the beginning. Okay. And therefore, there will seem to be a tension between faith, which is something that recognizes the supernatural, and science, which excludes it on an a priori level. It doesn't include it even as an option. Okay. And then I've already spoken about data. Data are always interpreted, and R is correct, by the way. Okay? You can say is, data is, but actually data is more than one, so it's R. Okay? It wasn't. I might have other typos, but that's one of them. Okay? So data are always interpreted to form meaning. Data by itself doesn't speak for itself. It needs the human brain, a person, or a group of people, or a bunch of scientists to think about it, to say, what does it mean? Therefore, the questions of the neuroscientific link between the soul, linked to the soul, will have to be informed by science, but also by philosophy, and by human thinking and human participation in the discussion. And as a result, it will be messier than just a scientific question. So, what I'm going to do for the rest of the talk, I'm going to ask a little bit about what does the Bible say about the soul, a little bit, just going to scratch the surface. Then I do want to speak a little bit about what neuroscience is, in very, very broad strokes. And then I want to ask about the interaction between these two things before I touch on two or three final things that I will need to offer. So, what does the Bible say? Look, I can quote many verses to you. I can have long discussions. I'm currently reading the Gospel of John. I don't think anybody who reads the Bible can say that the Bible is not fully committed to the idea of something called the soul. And we could ask what that is, of course we can, but I think the Bible is fully committed to the idea of something like the soul existing. And how it manifests and exactly what it's made of is a different question. That's more of a philosophical question. I don't think the Bible says anything about it. But verses like this, do not be afraid of those who kill the body but cannot kill the soul. Rather, be afraid of the one who can destroy both body and soul and body in hell. That's Jesus speaking. Okay? That's one example. I'm not saying that verse should convince you. Go and read your New Testament. Go and read the Gospel. You can't miss it. Okay? And one of the interesting examples is how Jesus interacts with the Sadducees and the Pharisees, and how Paul interacts and actually uses them, because some of them didn't actually believe in the existence of the soul and others did. And they use that to actually get them to fight against each other and sometimes to get out of sticky situations. Okay, but I think the Bible is full of it. The Bible is committed to the fact that the soul exists. As a matter of fact, the Bible is committed to the idea that an unembodied person can exist. As a matter of fact, the Bible is committed to the fact that an unembodied person is the one who created everything. We call that person God in the Christian speak. Okay? When God appears to Moses in the burning bush, is he a person? Of course he is. You can't doubt anything, well, if you want to know anything about the Christian point of view about who God is, He is a person. That he definitely is. But I need to ask you a question. Does God have a brain? He doesn't. God is not physical. He doesn't have a brain. So if he's a person and he doesn't have a brain, you raise it with an interesting thing. If you're a physicalist, if everything must be physical, then you cannot really believe that God can exist. Because in what does he exist if he doesn't have a brain? Or do you conceptualize God to have a brain? Okay, in which he exists. Because I don't, and I don't think the majority of Christians do. So, the question in essence, in the end, is, are you a physical being with the illusion that you have a soul? Because you have that illusion. Or are you a soul that is embodied, that lives in a body, that has a body? And I'm not trying to defend dualism here, that we are completely separate things. It's intertwined, of course it is. Okay? What I'm saying is, the question is, are you an embodied soul, or are you a body that has the illusion that you have a soul? And you don't really, I think, have a third choice. And I think Gazaniga makes that point beautifully. That we all act as if we are humans. So it's either an illusion or you do have a soul. And then JP says it beautifully. That he takes the Christian point of view and he states it as follows. He says, for 2,000 years, the vast majority of Christian scholars, pastors, and lay people have taken the Christian religion to be an immaterialist faith in the following sense. The vast majority of Christians have believed for 2,000 years that God exists and he is not physical, that angels and demons are real, and that they are not physical, and that the soul of men and beasts, as they used to be put by the church fathers, are real and they are not physical. Yeah? So the Christian religion, I think, says, and mails its colors to the world to say that the soul exists. So, let me ask you the question then. What is a soul? Because I think that's a crucial part of this question. If we're going to ask if neuroscience and the soul and the existence of the soul have anything to say to each other, we first have to ask, what is a soul? I don't want to make this too long. If I had a bit more time, I would ask you for a definition. What is the soul? Yeah. I think it's an important thing for you to be able to ask if you're going to think about the interaction between neuroscience and the soul. So I'm going to use J.P. Moreland's definition. I think it's a very useful definition of it. He says the following. The soul is an immaterial thing that contains consciousness and animates the body. Okay, it's a thing. He's calling it a thing. How's that for science, eh? It's a thing. Okay. It's an immaterial thing that contains consciousness and animates the body. And then he continues to say that the soul is like a chest of drawers. You know what a chest of drawers is? That you can pull out different drawers and it has different parts. And he names some of them. He's not trying to be exhaustive. But the soul has drawers containing your mind, your emotions, your will, and your spirit. They're all parts of yourself, according to what Jacob says. Now, there are very good Christian people out there who would say, no, the spirit is different from the soul. If you want to have that argument, I think we should have it after coffee on another day. I mean, you're welcome to ask the question. I'm just going to preempt it by saying, I think there are good Christian people who have that point of view, and they're welcome to have it. I'm using JP's point of view where he says that we've got the body and the soul and the soul contains the spirit. Okay? So that's the point of view I'm taking tonight. So, if that is the soul, okay, let's just spend one moment on consciousness as well. I like his example. So, remember he said what the soul is? Let me just go back up to that one for a second. It's an immaterial thing that contains consciousness and animates the body. Okay? So let's just spend one moment on consciousness then. What is he saying consciousness is? And he uses this beautiful description where he says, you go in for an operation and you get anesthesia and you knock out. Now you want to know what consciousness is. Think about that process of waking up. Okay? So there are certain sensations that start flowing into your body. You hear some noises. You can smell some stuff. Your mouth might feel dry. Okay? There are certain sensations that you have. They're not true or false. They're just experiences, sense experiences that come into your body. Then you start wondering, who am I? Where am I? What's going on? There are some thoughts happening in your brain. Okay? Then there are certain beliefs. You believe certain things. You might believe, I've just landed from an alien spacecraft. You know, I don't know what you think when you wake up from anesthesia. But you'll have some beliefs, okay, about where you are and what's going on. You might be thirsty. There might be some desire that you have. Okay? Or you might wonder where your family, closest family members are in that moment. And then there could be free acts of the will. And importantly, free acts of the will could might just be something that you want to do, but you can't. So you might wake up, open your eyes, see a glass of water, you want to lift your hand. That's a free act of the will, whether you've lifted your hand or not. Okay? It's a free decision you take to do something. Whether you're capable of doing it or not, it's not important. It's still a free act of the will. And those are all parts of consciousness. Now, I think it's important to say that when all of these things happen, sensations coming in through your senses, thoughts, beliefs, desires, free acts of the will, when all of these things happen, there will be electrochemical reactions inside your brain. There's no doubt about that. The question isn't whether they will be there, the question is what do they mean? Okay, nobody's arguing that they are there, especially not me tonight. I think the question is what do they mean? So let's take a little bit of time then and ask some very basic, very shallow questions about neuroscience. So that is the Christian position. So we have a soul, we've said a little bit about what that soul might contain, we spoke a little bit about consciousness. What is neuroscience then? Because we're trying to understand the relationship between these two things. Nobody snored yet, we're all still awake. Okay, right. We should open the coffee shop, I think. Maybe some coffee if necessary. Okay, so what is neuroscience? Now let's first ask the question, what does neuroscience say? Now this to me, look, if you haven't been astonished by anything tonight, you probably haven't, please be astonished. You're going to read that. It's Francis Collins, the head of the Human Genome Project. Medical doctor speaking, and he speaks about the brain, and he says the brain is the most complicated organ in the universe, as far as we know, as far as we can conceive. That's how complicated it is. We have learned a lot about other human organs. We know that the heart pumps and how the kidney does what it does. To a certain degree, we have read the letters of the human genome, but the brain has 100 billion neurons. Each of those has about 10,000 connections. It is the most complicated object in the universe sitting inside your skull right now. And what neuroscience is going to study is that. I think it's fascinating, and I think it's wonderful that we're going to study it. But I also want to say, if that's what you study, a high degree of humility should be part of all of our approaches to that highly complex thing. Those of us who look at it from a Christian point of view, but also those of us looking from a scientific point of view. Because this is going to take us eons to really understand. We have to be able to say that if this is how complicated it is, which Francis Collins tells us it is. So what is neuroscience? It's a branch, such as physiology, of the life sciences that deals with the anatomy, physiology, biochemistry, and molecular biology of nerves and the nervous tissue, and especially with relation to behavior and learning. So it's a scientific, mostly medical approach to understanding what's happening inside the brain, okay? And how that actually links to behavior and learning. So in a typical experiment, neuroscientific experiment, there might be electrodes linked to your head, not always, but sometimes. So to measure the electrical activity much more inside your brain. Now part of the difficulty studying the human brain is that very few people are willing to let you cut them open and study the brain active, right? It actually happens in brain operations. They do some actual experimental work on brains to a small extent. But it's quite difficult to study the brain because most people won't give you access to this, right? So you have to study it from the outside using electrodes and then using some other scanners. We'll talk about those other scanners at the moment. So magnetic resonance imaging or functional magnetic resonance imaging. MRI or fMRI machines, and I'll talk a little bit about the difference between them. I'm not an expert, I learned this as I prepared for this talk, but it's fascinating what they're able to do with those two different machines. And then the investigations of brain damage and altered individuals. So part of neuroscience is to actually go and look at people who have very specific brain injuries and to see how that changes them. Because that tells you how that links to their behavior. I mean, some of the studies in this book are fascinating. So they have removed up to half of some people's brains. And then they study what these people can do and what they can still do and what they can actually learn and not learn and what they've lost and what they're capable of. They've had to sever, not in many, but like in I think 70 or 80 instances, they've had to sever the two sides of the brain so that they're not connected anymore. Okay? Because Anina specifically specializes in that, to study people who have had the two sides of their brain severed from each other, but they're not connected. And then to study how that impacts their behavior and their ability to function. So that's another one. And then electrical stimulation of the brain is another way. So the experimental design is to try and understand what's happening inside the brain And it sometimes involves the person who is part of the experiment also speaking to you. So you might stimulate a part of the brain, you might ask them, what do they feel, what do they experience, what do they see, what do they smell? And it's fascinating to see what happens there. And I mean, if you start looking at what brain injuries do to people, it's fascinating. My wife is an audiologist, okay? And one of the famous examples there is of somebody who had trauma in the Second World War, and he suddenly started speaking with a German accent. It wasn't in Germany, he lived somewhere, I probably can remember, it was in France or somewhere, and suddenly this guy in this town was German. You know? And he started speaking with a German accent, and nobody could explain it, right? So let's look at some pictures of some of the neuroscientific experimentation. So there you see some people with electrodes on their brains, and here is a very nice Homer Simpson explanation of the difference between MRI and fMRI. So MRI studies the anatomy of the brain, shows you the structures of the brain. Okay, so it's a scan that goes through your skull and shows you the different structures of your brain. And then we can see how this little brain. Okay, and then functional MRI is this one here, and it shows that the electrical activity inside the brain as certain things are happening, or specific things are happening. Okay, so here we can see how has got different parts of his brain, sleep, donuts, beer, and a few other things in there. Okay, that's functional MRI, that's what fMRI will do for you. But these are all examples of people being studied as part of neuroscience. Okay. So, let me go back to the question. And this is sort of the end of the first part of my talk. So if you're still with me, you've done well. We're going to still go to some philosophy, and we'll end up with something nice and pleasant. Okay. But we'll get there right at the end. So, let's just go back to the fundamental question we're trying to discuss tonight. Now, I'm a scientist, but not in the hard sciences, I'm in the people sciences. My wife is an audiologist, and her PhD is in engineering, in the biomedical engineering field. Okay, so both of us are scientists. We work in the university sector. And if we had this as a statement, an immaterial thing that contains consciousness and animates the body, I cannot even come up with a suggested way of studying that scientifically. If you ask me if that exists, I cannot even imagine a way to set up an experiment to test whether it exists. And if anybody can come up with that experiment, I'd be fascinated to know what it would be. Because the scientific methodology studies the structures, the electrical functioning, the chemistry, the physics, all of that stuff. But if the soul is an immaterial thing, how would science find it? It sounds to me very much like the USSR's president saying, you did not find God there. So what these guys are saying, in my view, is we're looking inside the brain and we have not found any space for the soul. To me, that sounds very similar. I didn't expect you to find it inside the brain. I really didn't. Because that's not the Christian definition of what a soul would be. I don't think you can. Of course you can speak about it and you can learn aspects of it from a scientific point of view, but I do not think this is something that could be studied with the current scientific methodology. And I'm completely open at the end of tonight to have a further discussion about that. Let me use an analogy. So, let's say you arrive at a planet and there's this flat thing, these that they're flat, right? Now pictures on it all the time and there's stuff happening and you don't know what it is and you want to understand it. Okay. So sometimes it breaks down and it doesn't give you the proper image. And you've got both of these examples. Now you want to understand what's going on here. So what we do, as any good scientist will do, and this is the scientific approach, you take the machine and you take some of the broken ones and you go and study them to see. Okay, you can see there's a crack there, so that affects the way that I can see this. So there's clearly a link between what I can see and the integrity of this flat screen. You open up the back and you look at the different components, you try and understand them, and then you might actually put some electrodes on there to see as the pictures happen, what is happening electrically inside the television. Can you see that all of those are things you could scientifically do? You could study a television. But what you could not do, if you did not know that it existed, was tell me whether there was a signal animating that television, if by only studying the television itself from the outside. You couldn't. I don't think you can. My analogy might not work. You are asking questions in the thing. Okay? I don't think any of these three ways of studying a television, and remember now you know that there's a signal, so you would look for it, right? and you might have the equipment. So my analogy doesn't work exactly for the soul, but I do think it works in principle for the soul. Okay? The second thing I want to address here, after my analogy, is to say, I think it's really important to say that we often make this mistake of attributing causality to something whilst we have not established causality. Now, this is going to get a bit weird, I know. Okay, but this is important. If you want to understand scientific study, you must understand this principle. Correlation does not equal causality. What do I mean by that? Two things happening at the same time, even if they happen very often, does not mean the one is caused by the other. It doesn't mean it. As a matter of fact, it is a formal fallacy to say that something that happens with something else is caused by it, if you haven't established causality. There's a lot of work to be done if you want to establish causality, because it's not the same thing. Okay, so if the soul exists and is in a body, we would expect it to manifest bodily through the normal functions, systems, and features of the body, which we would be able to measure, and we'd be able to find correlations between certain activities and certain experiences. We would find that. Okay. And then here's just a little stick man joke. I used to think correlation implied causation. Then I took a statistics class, now I don't. So it sounds like the class helped you. Well, maybe. Okay? Because how do you know? Okay. So I, by the way, I'm not skeptical that causation can ever be established. I'm just wary of the fact that if we listen to a guy like Harris here, look what he's saying, everybody. Listen to what he's saying, and that's why I mark these words. How can we be free as conscious agents if everything that we consciously intend is caused by events in our brain? How has he established causality? Has he found a correlation? Yes. Has he established causality? No, he hasn't. He's jumping towards causality. But if the soul exists and is embodied, we would expect exactly the same thing that he is finding. Exactly. We would expect electrical activity when you are happy. When you have a certain emotion, you would expect electrochemical activity in your brain. You would expect it because you're an embodied soul. Okay? The question is whether it's causal in a true sense of in a final sense of the word causal. Okay? You are not in control of your mind because you, as a conscious agent, are only part of your mind, living at the mercy of the other parts. That's his view. But I don't think he has done enough work to establish causality. Here's a nice one for the bride next weekend. For you to use at the brine, this is what you call it, okay? The correlation proves causation is considered a questionable cause logical fallacy when two events occurring together are taken to have established a cause and effect relationship. Yeah, here's the nice one. This is the one you should practice, okay? The fallacy is also known as cum hoc ergo propter hoc. How's that? Okay, cum hoc ergo propter hoc. Latin for with this, therefore because of this, and false cause. Because two things happen together, you think they cause each other, but you haven't established that. You can, but it's not as easy as you think. Okay. And I would argue tonight that I think that's the fallacy that is being used here. Okay. Because Harris is basically saying all you are is your brain and your body. That's all you are. Physics, chemistry, and your brain. That's all you are. Okay, now I want to take his argument on it one more level. I've taken it on a few levels already. I don't think his experiments can prove it. Okay, that's my first point. My second point is I think he is confusing correlation with causation. They're not the same thing. And I'm not talking about correlation. Correlation is there. Correlation is not the same as causation. That's my second point. And that's taken long to get there. And you don't still seem quite okay with that. Now I want to make a third point, which is slightly more philosophical. This one might be slightly more difficult for some of you to swallow. Hopefully the first two are not too bad to swallow, but let's look at the third one, right? The third point is slightly more philosophical. So, Harris is saying, you are your brain, we are the same thing. Now, if that is true, we would expect the logical law of identity to apply. Because two things that are the same thing is identical, that are identical. So the law of identity says, in logic, the law of identity states that each thing is identical with itself. Now that sounds so weird, eh? That sounds quite postmodern. Yes. The law of identity states each thing is identical to itself. Sounds like you're saying nothing. But the point is, by this it is meant that each thing is composed of its own unique set of characteristics, qualities, and features, which the ancient Greeks called its essence. So let me make that slightly more practical. Two proposed things, if we say there are two things, a soul and a body, in this instance, then, if they are identical in all respects, it's only one thing. But if they are different in certain respects, we probably have two different things. Does that make sense? So my wife taught audiology 1A this year at the University of Pretoria. Okay, so if there is, so Marianne Fransel is my wife. She's also the audiology 1A lecturer at the University of Pretoria. If there is one thing that is true of Marianne Fransel that is not also true of the UP audiology 1A lecturer, they are not the same substance, but indeed two different substances. Does that make sense? I hope so. Okay. All right? Okay? We can come back to that if you need to. If this is too much and the first two arguments were enough, go in screensaver mode. Just don't snore. That's all I want. Okay. This is I know this is a bit dry. Okay, but it's important. So what I'm saying, according to Harris, the brain and the soul is one thing, and they're therefore identical to each other. They should be. Okay? And if my brain and my soul is the same thing, everything that is true about the one must also be true about the other. That's the point. Okay. So if I am my brain, then everything that is true about my brain should also be true about my soul, and everything that's true about my soul should be true about my brain. Otherwise, they're not the same thing. Okay? So here are four ways in which your brain and you differ. This is slide 28 of 30. So you're almost there. This is like Polly Shorts. Okay? Conference. You're almost there. Okay? So, here we go. The body and brain can be subdivided, but I cannot. Let me illustrate that. If I cut off your arm, are you still you? Yes, you are. Completely. If I cut off both your legs and both your arms, are you still you? Yes, completely. If I cut out, there are large parts of your brain that I can cut out, and you stay you. Absolutely. Okay? So, if you are your brain and I cut a part of it out, why have you not lost a part of who you are? They are the same thing. They should be identical, and both of them, if I cut out one piece, the other one must also have lost a piece. If the audiology 1A lecturer loses a tooth, then Marianne Fransel has lost a tooth. That's the point. It has to be like that if they are exactly the same thing. Okay? The second thing that's different. I can possibly exist without my body, but my brain cannot. Whoa, that's esoteric. It is at least possible that you can exist without your brain. I mean, even in sci-fi, we read of people uploading themselves onto the internet. What is that? If you are your brain, how can you upload yourself onto the internet? What would that even mean? Because you're your brain, are you going to upload your brain onto the internet? No, you're not. But that means you cannot be your brain. If you can potentially, and we all know, when I say you can potentially, possibly exist without your brain, we all know that to be a possibility at least. Okay? And your brain, you cannot imagine your brain without your body, without your brain. In other words, without the physical structures, because they are the physical structures. The third one. I, by all indications, have free will. And Harris is right. If I did not exist, and all we have is physics and chemistry and time, then free will cannot exist. I think that is logically they follow. The two things follow each other. If there is nothing supernatural, you are only the product of physics, chemistry, and time. That's what you are. And then you cannot have free will. You are the result of these processes. That's it. That's all you are. And free will is an illusion at best. And I think free will definitely exists. And if you don't think it does, please give me your cell phone and I'll leave with it. Okay? Right? Well, I'll take it from you if you want. Okay? And then the last one. If you replace parts of a thing one by one, it becomes a new thing. But molecules and cells in your body are constantly being replaced, and yet you remain the same. So let me illustrate what all that means. This is one of his arguments. If I take this chair, I take off one leg and I replace it with another leg, and I chuck the leg to the side. Then the other leg and I chuck it to the side. Then the other leg and I chuck it to the side. Then the other leg and I chuck it to the side. Then the base and I chuck it to the side. Then this bit and I chuck it to the, put a new one in. In the end, is it still the same chair? No, it's not. It's a new chair. Okay? It is. And the interesting thing is, in your body, your cells and some of the chemistry in your body is being replaced all the time. As a matter of fact, you're not the same person you were 10 years ago. You're completely very different, almost totally different, because everything is being renewed. How can you stay the same while your body's parts are being replaced one by one? No bits. Now, if we go into small parts, I know the structures continue looking the same, but you're not the same part that you were 10 years ago. Okay, and that's just a physical brute fact. Okay, so those are all philosophical reasons why we think the law of identity tells us that you are not just your body. Okay, just four arguments, and they're all arguable, I understand that. My second last slide, and then I'm going to end off, and then hopefully you can go if you want to. Okay. So my second last slide has to do with, what about animals? What about Fido, your dog? Actually, when I spoke in Afrikaans, Chris started with his dog being really ill, and it worked beautifully for us. Okay. But I think we all wonder about our dogs and our cats and our budgies, etc. And do they have souls? So once again, I learned a lot in preparing this, and I like what Lauren says. Lauren says that animals have souls, but those souls are different from ours. Okay? Does that mean your dog will go to heaven? I have no clue. Okay? But what Lauren says is, there are four ways in which your dog's soul is different from a human soul. The first one is, they have no second-order thoughts or needs. In other words, they have no thoughts about thoughts. Your dog doesn't. Your dog sees food. Oh, food. Oh, eat. Then it doesn't go back and think, I'm a bit drowned at the moment. Should I have just jumped into that food? It doesn't do that. Have you noticed? Okay? Doesn't care. Okay. Doesn't think about its own thinking. No lion catches a buck and then it thinks, should I have killed it a bit? Was that not a bit sadistic? It doesn't. Okay? No animal has second order thoughts, and it also doesn't have second order needs. In other words, needs about needs. Did you know that you have needs about needs? Sometimes so for example, a guy, okay, I was only married at 37. Okay? So I married very late. But before then, I wanted to be ready to be married. I wanted to be ready to have that need, but I just couldn't get there. I had a need about a need that actually became something. And as humans, we complicated that. We have needs about our needs and thoughts about our thoughts. No animal, as far as we know, has that. Okay? That's why we don't hold animals morally culpable for anything they do. If a lion kills a human, we shoot it, not because we take it to court, we have a long session about whether what it did. No, we go out there, shoot it. Why? Because once it's caught a human, it found something without a lot of hair, without any horns, nice and plump. Hey, great food! What is it going to eat next time? A human. Okay? It's great food. Therefore, we have to shoot it. But it's got nothing to do with moral culpability. Okay? Secondly, as far as we know, no animal has a spiritual dimension. This is interesting. There are millions of organisms on this planet. None of them are spiritual. And we have to go to the opposite side. Did you know that they've never found a society ever that is not religious? Ever. Ever. They've gone across the whole globe, and all humans are religious in some way, shape, or form. All of us. We are the only organism that is religious, and all of us, except a few white males that are middle-aged and rich. Okay, it's not quite as simple as that, but the majority of atheists are white, middle-aged men who are rich. Really, it's true. Okay? I'm not saying that it's racist. I'm not saying therefore atheism is false. I'm just saying we could just as well be called homo religiensis. Because as human beings, all of us are religious in some way, shape, or form. Okay? And that's an interesting fact. But no other animal has a spiritual dimension as far as we know. Next one. Animals don't have true free will. What we mean by that is they are to a large degree, actually totally determined by their instincts. Okay? There is food. Eat. Okay? That's it. That's what determines their behavior. All of it, as far as you know, is instinct. Okay? None of it is true free will. Where they think, I am Fido. I will now chase the neighbor's cat. No. Cat, help! There they are. That's what they do. Okay, so there's no free will in the true sense of the word. And then they have no moral imperatives or culpability. They're not moral. I know you can say bad dog, but that's not the same as bad human. But Lord, why do you grovel? That you're the alpha. And you look upset. Why do you think the poor animal's going to do? Grovel. They don't really understand you. And as humans, we pretend to take these human attributes and bestow them on our animals. And that's beautiful. There's nothing wrong with it. I'm just saying, scientifically, there is no evidence that they have those attributes. Okay? So in all scientific studies, we find that they don't. So my last slide, let me sum up. So what is my conclusion? I think it's clear that the Bible, now listen to these lines of evidence. The Bible contends that we have souls. The basically human, universal human experience. So my second line of evidence is universal human experience shows that people act and behave as if they have souls, or at least exist. The whole social structure of society is built on the assumption that we are real and that we have souls. Without souls, the whole social structure should be much more like the animals. Okay? It should be survival of the fittest. We shouldn't look for fairness. What does it even mean? Okay? Because it would be meaningless. Look at those strong three lines of argument from experience and from the way society exists. Okay, if you're going to say what Harris says, you must understand that at least those two, you're going to have to convince us as humanity. And then the really meaningful human experiences of love and sorrow, those deep, really life-changing experiences can only exist. And we all know that they are the things that make life really meaningful. I don't think the scientific method has the ability. And by that, I'm not criticizing science. Okay, it's like if I said to you, you are using a microscope to study something, but you can't see the stars. I'm not criticizing your science. You chose to use a microscope. It has certain wonderful capabilities. Please use it. Please continue using it. All strength to you. It's wonderful. But please understand that you've chosen the methodology of research that has its own limitations. And just accept that as part of what we are discussing. And I have no doubt in my own mind that the scientific method has that built into itself, that it can never look for anything outside physics, science, time, cause. Okay? Although and I think we must be careful, scientists give their opinion and then it sounds like they're speaking science. They're not. What do they know? What is it based on? Okay? Is it based on any experimental evidence? And often the answer is no. They're just speaking their opinion as scientists, and we take it as if it's true. And then lastly, I think there is a very strong reason to accept both the Christian understanding of the existence of a non-material soul and to welcome neuroscience. I think both of those things should be welcomed, and both of those can be defended side by side. I don't think they have to be one or the other. And as a matter of fact, I think the truth is that if an unembodied God exists, who became embodied in his Son, I mean, it might sound like a fairy tale to somebody, but if that is true, if an unembodied God exists, and he became embodied in his Son, and through Jesus, he came to live the life we should have lived and died the death we should have died, it changes everything. It changes everything. Right? And I think the human soul resonates with that. And I think if it resonates with you, you will find that it's your soul that resonates with you. Okay? I'm going to stop there, Chris. I'm not going to pray right now, we'll pray right today, maybe. Let's see if there are any questions.
Thank you so much. Can I give him a hand? Even a praying prayer. No, that was very interesting. Thank you, Andre. Unfortunately, one of our microphones isn't working. So we just have the one microphone. So if I'm asking this question, I'm going to give you the mic, then just give the mic back to Andre. Just asking.
Thank you. Sorry, thank you for a most fascinating talk. I find this very fascinating, well, because of its implications for artificial intelligence. So, because we don't really know what consciousness is, I mean, you know, we have an experience of consciousness, but there's no way for you to prove that you're conscious. You just basically convince me that you are, and so I accept it. And therefore, you know, one could expect that if there is a sufficient intelligence that's non-biological, it could develop a consciousness. So this is an expectation. among some people. I don't expect that to happen because I am a dualist as well. So, but it's fascinating, and I think as this development happens, we may find out a lot more about what we are as humans when we see the limits of non-biological fit. So I want to mention a couple of things that I think make this more complicated, if you perhaps consider, and this is not to counter what you said, because I have to agree, but I think it's many things to keep in mind. So the dualism that you're talking about is really a substance dualism, in the sense that we're positing two different substances. So we're saying that the immaterial part, that's the soul, is really a completely, it's an actual separate substance somehow. But I think there are more nuanced dualisms that aren't completely materialist, or at least people who aren't materialists hold to a supervenient effect. So water has the property of wetness, which neither hydrogen nor oxygen has, but somehow the molecule, that is the property that it has. And so, you know, the substance dualism that we hold to is also an interaction, you know, so that there's not only things that you physically experience affect your consciousness, but the other way around as well. So that's where the free will comes in, is that we believe that we have the ability to actually cause actions in the real world that go the other way. But this view is really a unidirectional flow. And so that is something to think of, because it has implications for the identity argument that you're looking at. Because I don't think a lot of people hold to a view that, although I don't know, I didn't do a survey, but it seems to me unlikely that a lot of people have the view that there is really the identity, as you say, you know, between material and an illusional immaterial body. So there is the illusion of consciousness, but it's because, it's really because of somehow this supervenient effect. And what I'm also wondering about is, you're talking about correlation that doesn't imply causation, which I actually agree with, but there's, in some cases it's fairly obvious. Pain induces certain, you know, psychological experience, and the timing is such that, you know, we can kind of know unambiguously that there must, you know, there is causation there. So I don't think it's controversial to say that, you know, we've got the from the physical to the non-physical part that there is causation. It seems to me the part that's controversial here is really whether there is in the other direction.
I'm not writing this down, so I'm going to try and remember what
I think we're going to need some real time to spend on this. Of course, I have read a little bit about those supervenient emergences of consciousness. I'm not going to try and nail myself down to exactly what type of dualist I am. I do think it's substance dualism to a large degree tonight. And I do think I lie on the side much closer to substance dualism. I don't think it's dichotomous. I don't think you have to choose between exact substance dualism or nothing. I don't think that's true. I play the two off against each other tonight. And I think in between those two things, there are a lot of different options available that one could think about. I am worried, however, when people try and call themselves dualists when it's only an emergent part of the brain, the emergent function of the brain, this personhood of us. I don't think, to me, that's not strong enough. I don't think that's good enough. I don't think, to me, that could still all lead back to physics, chemistry, and time. And that takes away some of the most important aspects of us being dualists, having a soul, right? My view. And I think we need to spend some time having that discussion. So I'm aware of that point of view, but I think the Bible, you will more easily defend, I think, substance dualism, the biblical view, but not substance dualism as the Greeks had it, in terms of the body and the soul are completely different. It's an integrated whole, of course they are. As we are an embodied soul, you are an integrated whole. I think there's a lot to be said for a biblical view of substance dualism. And I think Dalai JP defends it very nice. I'm not going to say anything about the artificial intelligence at the moment. The second point that you made that I think I just do want to respond to, I don't think you can use pain and its registration in the brain to make the point that you're making. I think it's a category mistake. Because you're talking of a sensation registering in the brain. That's not what we're talking about. Who has the sensation? That's what we're talking about. And that's in a different category. Okay? I don't think we need to argue that point that you made. I think it's true. I think a daily
But I think we would have to spend some time on that too, because I'm not sure that you can make that causal. Because not everybody experiences fear when they experience pain. And if it were causal, everybody would have to experience that if it were truly causal. And it's not true. Some people actually get addicted to pain. They love it. Okay? It doesn't always cause fear, etc. So I'm just saying, I think true causality means in circumstances that are the same, you always find the same result. You could do it experimentally all over the place and find the same thing. Then it's true causality, the strong physics sense of the word. You can't establish it with the example, I think. Even I think I can give counter-examples that would bring real questions to that example. Because I can see the pain registry. I can't see the psychological experience being causative effects. I don't take that point at all. Because it would be a secondary effect of the nail finger. And I'm not sure that you've established causality there. But that could be another discussion. Yeah. I think he's got more, but
I'm talking. You should be cast to the coffee.
Yeah.
thanks, Andre. One quick observation that you may or may not respond to. You said on the animal thing, you said that there have been scientifically proven that, but in your talk previously you said that science can't prove those things. So I don't know if you're contradicting yourself there, but that's one thing. The other thing is, I used to be quite a fully convinced substance dualist, and then I spoke to a mutual friend of ours, you know, Andrew, and he sent me some interesting articles on Christian monism, which some thoughtful Christians do adhere to, which would say that yes, we have a soul, or the way I would interpret it is, it's difficult to speak of the soul without the body, or to make those things so separate, because you can drink pills that would enhance your willpower, which we would normally ascribe to the soul, or if you have certain brain injuries, anything that we would say would be a property of the soul would change, right? Your friendliness, or your, how you react to certain things, or whatever you can put on that list would change. So there is this, as Isaac mentioned, this bi-directional relationship between the body and the soul, and so speaking of ourselves with other bodies is very difficult. I wouldn't say I'm convinced that it's true, but maybe I should add that you spoke about causality and the TV and stuff like that. What I would say about the TV analogy is that it's not that the image gets broken, it's that the signal is sending the rugby, but you're watching Days of Our Lives. You know, it's a completely different picture. It's not just a distorted picture, but it's as if the personality changes, or those properties of the soul changes. They aren't just corrupt. Maybe you can argue that they're corrupt, but I'd be interested to hear your views on that. I'm not convinced either way, but it's well.
Okay, the first thing I want to say just about the animals, I do think the stuff that I said on there could be investigated scientifically even for humans. I'm not saying animals didn't have a soul. I didn't even talk about that. Okay, so I think you're mixing two things up. I think human emotions, etc., can be studied scientifically. I think the soul cannot be identified scientifically. Those are two separate things, and I'm agreeing that animals have souls. So I don't think I contradicted myself there, just to say. I think they're two different things. Look, I have absolutely, absolutely no problem with thinking about myself and body. None. I mean, people might have a problem with it. And I'm not saying it's as if I understand every aspect of it. I can just tell you, I have absolutely no problem. I don't see the problem. I don't understand what the problem is. And I would love the problem to be explained to me. I know there are Christians that have different views, and I think one could hold a different view.
I think the Hebrews from which Jesus came, through which Revelation came, were not Jewish in the sense that we in the West are Jewish. I think they were much more integrated than we are. I think our form of Jewish thinking about ourselves is way too far towards non-Hebrew thinking. It's way too Jewish. I don't think that either. I agree with integrated whole while we are in body. I have no issue with it. But I disagree with the fact that it's difficult to think about myself in disembodied. Is it then also difficult to think about God being disembodied for those people? Because if it's not, why? If they can think about God being a disembodied person, why can they not think of themselves then? I struggle to see how they make that link. Now, not God, I'm not saying that, I'm a person. In that way, I'm reflecting. I was made in his image. As a result of that, I have absolutely no issue. A person, I can only speak for myself. You know? I think as a good Christian, the person is a good Christian. A good Christian just means that they put their weight on Christ. That's what makes you a good Christian. You can't carry yourself, he carries you. Okay? I think we could. This is a non-essential in terms of exactly how we understand it. I was asked to speak about whether neuroscience brings any doubt about the existence of the soul. And to some people it does. It might not be the majority, but to some people it does. Some people, it actually is some of their main ambition against the existence, the possible existence. So that's what I would address. I am, as I said, not an expert in this. I mean, that's why I love that you guys talk, because I think there is a lot of things to be done about it. But that doesn't change where I stand on this. And as I said, I can't see that difficult that you're speaking about, and I would want to understand that.
No, thank you so much for the talk. My question, sorry, is actually on a subset of what you define as the soul, on free will. I think you'll know that's quite a big thing that's been targeted in neuroscience. And when you start speaking about, we must make the mistake of confusing correlation and causation, it struck me that by whatever criteria you are using, the effect can never precede the cause. So, if I was following correctly, behavior and activity in the brain would then be a reflection or an effect of the soul. Is that, and if that is what you are implying, then critical effect for free will, because of his a set of experiments that started with the Libet experiments, and after that, I can't remember who did it, where they bring these people up to fancy brain scan equipment, where they could predict the choice, or rather the action, that a person was going to take 8 seconds before the person was consciously aware of making the decision. Thinking that, you know, they would do so. So if all that brain activity is merely an effect of the conscious decision to do so, it could not possibly proceed.
I don't agree with your last sentence, of course. Okay, so the reason I can't, I actually have one more point to go back to Harold, but you can just get onto this first. So I think that data is fascinating, right? The question is, what does it mean? So how did they know when people became consciously aware of something?
Self-reported.
Oh, self-reported. Can you understand how that complicates the whole experiment? And I'm not saying it makes it invalid. It just means you must think very carefully about what you can conclude from that experiment. Because if something is self-reported, you have to press a button, or you have to put up your hand, or you have to do something about it. But can you imagine the complexity that must have taken place in between there? And if you speak about the cause cannot precede the effect, right? Then you are thinking of two things that are the effect cannot precede the cause. Sorry? If you think about it that way, you are asking a question about timing. It's in essence a timing question, right? And you're thinking of it as a straight line, things happen. If this is an integrated whole, and you're trying to measure timing, you're trying to measure something that is incredibly difficult to measure using an outside measurement unit and self-reported.
Because I'm not saying that all of the soul is at a conscious level. Who said that? Nobody said that. A lot of what happens inside your soul is at a subconscious level. Okay? And your conscious awareness of it needn't be the only reflection of what a soul is. So what I'm saying is, the complexity of what is being investigated just means that those conclusions are, it's a fascinating set of experiments, and I have read a little bit of it, I'm not an expert, but I have read a little bit of it. I don't think those experiments can really support the conclusion that they are making with you, that you've made tentatively here. I don't think they're strong enough. That's because I think there's a lot of questions to be asked about the methodology and about what it means if I were to be an embodied soul. What would I expect to see? What could be measured? And would the soul's initiation of that decision, would it show any electrochemical? Would it necessarily? I don't know if it's a spiritual aspect of who we are in terms of material. Okay, so I'm just saying, I think conclusions when it comes to these measurements are very difficult. I'm going to stop there with that part of the answer. But I think, once again, we can spend a lot of time on this. What I tried to say tonight in terms of the methodology is, I think we must be very careful with data or interpret. Just be careful and humble enough about the confusions that we have. Because if we are studying the most complex object in the universe, and if the total human experience, the total human society, and a lot of other evidence shows us that there might be more to it than just the electrical activity, we must just be careful. And I think those experiments, the conclusions that are drawn from them, are way. I don't think that says anything about people necessarily. It could, but it's not necessarily so. Okay. I'm going to come back to an example of the television that's broken. I think the television analogy works really well, because there could be parts in the television that break and start showing that program. I can't see why that is problematic at all. As a matter of fact, I think the television analogy works really, really well. Because what you would then observe would look very different to what you observed before if an internal part is broken. And I don't think that, I don't agree with that part of your argument in that. I think, and I mean, the television is, obviously my analogy is limited, right? The TV is not the most complex object in the universe. Your brain is. And what we're saying is something interferes with the physical workings of that object in a bad way. What the effect of that is going to be to the observer must be incredibly difficult to predict and could be as complex as anything and as varied as anything that you could even imagine. And that's what we see in brain regions, you know? But I don't think it speaks to the existence of the eye or the soul. It does speak to our ability to observe that or and express that soul through the body that we're looking at. The question would be, if that person became unembodied, which I hold to that is possible, who would that be? Okay. The one that you observe, and let me give you one example of that. My wife's grandfather got Alzheimer's, and it took him away piece by piece. But the one thing we prayed for every night, we prayed for him, is that God would reach him right there where he was. And I have no doubt that he could, if he exists, and I think he does. And as a result, I don't think the fact that his brain took him away piece by piece, changed his personality, changed everything about him, says anything about who he is or his soul. Okay, it says that the most complex object in the universe got broken. And its results are difficult to observe.
Okay, I'm going to make this the last two questions. So if you ask them together, because our time is running out. So.
Mine's just a short comment. I think it's supporting what you say, maybe speaking to what these two were saying. So I teach acting, that's what I do all day, every day, and what I've learned is that the body is very stupid. So we can trick our body into feeling the sensation of guilt or hope or whatever, and it will have the same effect on your body. And so for example, if you watch a movie, you get fear, you have a real sensation of fear. So our bodies do not know the difference between reality and non-reality. So it's not a good correlation to make between the soul and the body, because the body is very dumb. It can be tricked into feeling anything, and that's what I do on a daily basis. And they can actually call up the emotions very quickly and the experience of, you know, fully experiencing something at a whim. It's not so difficult, and then they can quickly snap out of it as well. So there's actually, I would put emotions outside of the soul, honestly, because I think that we are, it's a lot more instinctual, and a lot more physical, and I think we actually have more control over that from our soul perspective, from the spirit. Yeah, then we think. Yeah.
Yes, I'd also like to comment, actually adding on to my the previous comment, because I also agree that the emotions are not necessarily part of the soul. I mean, it's all very ill-defined in that sense. But according to me, if you look at the soul is a timeless being, and now it is, when that my words and our idealism, but it's a timeless being that is now put into a time capsule, timeless soul, that's how I have it. And that's why I think that the cause and effect is very hard to define. But another interesting thing that I caught up on your talk is that the one of the things that can maybe be proved that we have souls is the lack of causality. The thing that one person, if you have a person A and B, and person A and B are very similar in all aspects, but person A and B have very different reactions. Why is that?
Same thing.
Yes.
Thank you. Okay, thanks guys. Once again, Andre, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.